From Dublin, Ireland, this is a Phantom 105.2 podcast. Check out phantom.ie for full podcast and programme information.
Well, first of all, Paul, thanks a million for taking the time to visit us here on Phantom 105.2 and share your thoughts about the Joshua Tree 20 years on.
Not at all. I love coming here.
Great stuff. I'd like to start, first of all, with the genesis of the Joshua Tree, as in The Unforgettable Fire contains many of the band's best-loved songs, but it's been described, not least by Bono, as being somewhat unfocused. Was there a conscious decision in recording, going in to record the Joshua Tree, that you'd go for a more song-based approach?
I think you're right. The Unforgettable Fire was the first album we'd made with Eno and Lanois, and that came at a kind of crossroads. Up till then, I think people expected U2 to develop into a big kind of 80s version of The Who. And they were going to be a straight-ahead stadium rock band, and a lot of people were very pleased about that, not least our record company. And when we took the decision to ask Eno to produce the album, Chris Blackwell, in particular, was very disturbed, and he thought this was likely to produce a very esoteric and non-commercial record. In fact, Jimmy Iovine would have been his preferred choice of producer. And I remember Chris came over to Dublin to try and talk us out of it. And Eno wasn't even that keen. Eno had said no, and Bono had said to me a number of times, just get him on the phone, and I'll talk to him, and he can't say no. I'll talk him round. So eventually, Bono persuaded, and he is a very persuasive person, he persuaded Eno to come over for a meeting. And Eno brought with him this guy, Danny Lanois, and we didn't know Danny, and weren't really expecting him. And I think it was Eno's intention to kind of gracefully absent himself from the project and hand it to Danny Lanois. And that didn't happen. They agreed to do it together. The Unforgettable Fire was a sort of transition album, one of my favorite U2 albums, and it really set up the working relationship, which then led to the Joshua Tree.
Back in 1987, in the middle of the Joshua Tree tour, you gave an interview to Propaganda magazine, and you said, I thought The Unforgettable Fire was a wonderful record, but The Joshua Tree was an extraordinary achievement. In what terms specifically back then, as opposed to now with 20 years and how it's grown as an iconic album, back then, what specifically did you think was an extraordinary achievement when it came to The Joshua Tree?
I suppose the structures, the songwriting, the focus, the wealth of material, the ambition, all of those things seemed to come together. There was no time wasted getting to know Brian and Danny. They just went to work. There was so much material that we ended up with a set of very, very good B-sides. We were putting out two good tracks per single release, and they've been reassembled in this anniversary package, as well as a number of other songs that didn't make the album at all. And just that enormous quantity of material gives you an indication of how prolific they were at the time. And it was very exciting to see this material coming through. It was obviously very much referenced to America. We had spent an enormous amount of time in America through the 80s. From 1981, 82, we were regularly spending 3-4 months of each year on the road in America. And the band was a much bigger live band in terms of the audiences they could draw than the record sales would indicate. And all these things kind of came together, and you know, the timing, the serendipity, whatever, the karma, the market, everything coincided in 1987 with this terrific record.
Okay, so if we can move on to the recording of the Joshua Tree itself, there's been reports that where the Streets of No Name took possibly about 40% of the total time. And Brian Eno has said that he tried to engineer an accident that would wipe the tape so they could start over and not be getting bogged down in what they'd already recorded. If you'd been in the studio at the time, would you have helped him or would you give him a clip around the ear?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, the producer is working for the artist,
yeah.
You know, and he, in the end, does what they want.
Mm-hmm.
Brian is, you know, he's a recording artist in his own right. He's a songwriter. He's been involved in a lot of records over his career. But the most successful ones have been the ones where he was working for you too.
Yeah. And if we move on then to a song like we were saying earlier on, that maybe 40% of the time was spent trying to work out Streets. And then you've got a song like One Tree Hill, which Bono insisted on only doing one vocal take on for obvious reasons. It was, though the album was dedicated to Greg Carroll, that song was specifically about Greg Carroll. Mm-hmm. And he said, if I try another take, it just won't work. I either get it in one take or it stays off the album. So it made the set list then for, I think, the third leg of the Joshua Tree tour, a couple of outings on the Lovetown tour, but hasn't been played since. Do you think does Bono find it still too emotionally difficult to sing?
Well, it has been played since. We have to play it in New Zealand.
Right.
And we were there recently. In New Zealand, that track actually went to number one.
Right.
As a single. It was only released as a single in New Zealand and is still a staple, mm-hmm. On New Zealand radio. And the reference is to a tree that has since been cut down by some random lunatic that's in the middle of Auckland. No, that was a very emotional piece of material. I mean, Greg Carroll, the guy who was killed, was actually going out with my sister. And I remember Bono and my sister Katie and Larry and Anne and Ali. They all made the trip out to New Zealand with his body.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two funerals. I mean, he was a Maori, but he was also a Christian, and in some confused way, both Maori and Christian services were held, and the mourning rituals went on for days and days and days.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we obviously felt, it was a terrible tragedy, and the imagery in the song kind of reflects it. But the mere fact of having taken this young guy away from New Zealand, he was very excited and happy to come. But he then came and settled in Dublin, worked with us here, and we were bringing him back to his people in a box. Of course, that was very emotional.
Yeah, let's go on to the image of you two in the 80s. They were. I know it's an image that annoyed them of this very serious young men, and they've since managed to shake that off. I suppose, firstly, primarily with the antics on the Zoo TV tour, but I suppose if you're writing songs with the intense lyrical imagery of Running to Stand Still and Bullet the Blue Sky, would you agree that you run the risk of feeding the perception of serious young men?
Yeah, I mean, I think they were very serious at the time. I mean, the photography and the kind of visual style of the record and the campaign was quite austere, and that kind of pilgrim look, you know, mm-hmm. in the desert. A lot of that had to do with Anton Corbijn, who always seems to be able to catch them looking serious. A few seconds later, they might be roaring with laughter, but Anton's a very kind of lugubrious, slightly dour Dutchman, and I don't think he likes to see people grinning and laughing very much. He's a little odd, actually. And he once photographed my other client, PJ Harvey, wearing a beard. So he's capable of extremely eccentric behaviour.
Staying with the idea of photography then, let's get on to the Time magazine cover, a pivotal moment for the band. And in the new DVD, with as part of the deluxe box set, you can see them doing the shoot. How did that Time magazine cover come about? Because it really, that sent you to Supernova in America, didn't it? The fourth band, only the fourth band ever to be on the cover of Time.
Yeah, it was a major moment, obviously. And the thing about being on the cover of Time magazine is that, you know, it is a news magazine, and you really don't know that you've got the cover, or that, you know, events won't overtake you. And I do remember speaking to Madonna once, and she said, "Oh yeah, I was going to be on the cover of Time magazine, and I lost it to a fucking earthquake." So I remember, we obviously knew we were up for it, but anything could have happened. And there was a moment I remember. It must have been sometime on a Saturday, because the publication day of Time magazine is Monday. Mm. There is a point on a Saturday when they have to commit the cover.
Yeah.
And I remember our publicist at the time, Paul Wasserman, who died a couple of weeks ago, actually.
So I heard, yeah.
Coming into my room on that Saturday in the Sunset Marquee Hotel in Los Angeles, which was where we used to stay. And he said, "I just got the call. They're on the cover. The presses are rolling." Mm-hmm. So that was a very exciting moment.
And I suppose then that was, I think it was just before the first leg of the Joshua Tree tour in America, when you mentioned that at the end of the Unforgettable Fire tour, the band were playing 15,000-seat arenas. And the first leg of the US Joshua Tree tour was more arenas. But when you went back, you did Europe. Then you went back to America and you were booking stadiums. Did you see that as a landmark for the band?
Yeah, we did. You know, the demand was there. Ticket prices in those days were much lower. Mm. And, you know, our agents were screaming all over the world. Promoters wanted to do more shows with you too. And we had always made it, you know, it was always very important to you to be, to find the audience for the music, mm-hmm. and for the records and for the shows worldwide. We didn't like it if one territory was lagging behind. We were quite imperialistic, mm-hmm. and I remember one of the last European countries to succumb, mm-hmm. was Germany. In fact. In more recent times, it's pretty well homogeneous. Mm-hmm. U2's records go to number one everywhere. But sure, at that time we were playing arenas. We were starting to, you know, we'd studied other bands who played arenas. Funnily enough, the people who managed and did the production for Journey, mm-hmm. were very helpful to us. And we'd seen the way that they built a stage that stood at one end of the arena, mm-hmm. but they also sold tickets behind. They sold seats behind. That was a kind of question at the time, whether it was right or fair to sell behind the stage.
Right, yeah.
We decided we would, and we've done it ever since. Mm. And I think it's very much part of the excitement of a U2 show, that you can kind of look through the band, yeah. and you can see the audience the other side. And people expect that, and it's part of what we do. The productions are designed knowing that that's going to be the kind of visual environment in which the audience see the show. And the other thing I think we started doing very early on that has stayed with us is the band have always put a lot of effort into getting great opening acts. Mm. And if you look at the lists of bands that have opened for U2, mm-hmm. over the years, you will actually see a long list of bands that subsequently made it.
Yeah.
So we always tried to do that. We thought it was part of the, you know, the excitement of going to a U2 show, that there'd be a great opening act, maybe more than one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think on the Joshua Tree tour, I remember people as diverse as the Pretenders and the Bodines and Los Lobos, all sorts of different characters.
The video for Streets, we all know the video, the famous police shutting down the location. So the video shoot didn't really go according to plan, but you must have been thinking, this is even better. This is going to make a great video.
Well, you know, the plan for that video evolved over quite a period of time. The producer of our videos at that time was a guy called Michael Hamlin, and Myrt Avis from When Mullane was the director. And I suppose there was a reference implicit in the whole thing to the Beatles shoot on the roof of number 3 Savile Row, which was the Apple building.
Mm.
And that was the last time they performed together. And the police came on the roof and made them stop. So when we shot that video in downtown Los Angeles, I think it was on the corner of 7th Street and Main, we had permits from the police, and they had picked up from the number of parking inquiries they got on their parking line that there were going to be huge crowds. It had leaked somehow on radio that there was going to be a U2 show. And in fact, the police were extremely understanding. And I can now tell the truth about this. It's a long time ago. The police helped and kept extending the time we had. And, of course, that wasn't what we really wanted. We wanted them to close us down.
Yeah.
And we kept saying, oh, can we just have another half an hour? And they were very, very good-humoured about it and kept extending the time and wouldn't do the thing we wanted, which was to close us down. And eventually the guy who was the police captain, eventually he did close us down, which was, of course, what we wanted.
Yeah.
And then we cut the film together to tell that story.
Right.
But afterwards, he wrote to me, that same police captain, and he said, I just want you to write back to me and confirm that in fact, we gave you every possible facility and you provoked us into closing you down, because he says, my daughter doesn't believe it and she won't believe it unless you tell her.
Yeah.
So I wrote him the letter. That is actually the true story of being closed down by the LAPD.
Good stuff. I just staying on Streets then. In the Rolling Stone interview at the time, they said, and I'm going to quote this, it doesn't contain any surefire smash hits, which is a bit laughable now considering the singles that were taken from it and what they did for the band. But, like, surely only the cloth-eared wouldn't see Streets as a huge hit.
Well, Streets wasn't a number one single. With or Without You was a number one single and still haven't found... was a number one single. This is in America. Streets didn't go to number one. Yes, it seemed to me that record was absolutely full of hits. And we knew that as we were finishing the record, and the record was, like many U2 records, hard to get over the line to actually complete it, finish it, nail it. Usually, many times in the past, has involved bringing in Steve Lillywhite to mix, which is not what he's best known for. He's best known for being a producer, but many times he has come in and, bit like the Cavalry, kind of simplified things, edited things, brought them back to their basics, and he did mix the tracks that were singles on that album, With or Without You, Still Haven't Found, Streets, and I think one other. And he's great at that. I knew, I think, you know, from months previously that we were getting ready for a very big record. We had a fairly, we had a good relationship with Island Records, but there wasn't anyone really in Island Records who A&R'd the band. We were pretty much self-sufficient in that respect. Jimmy Iovine, who was not producing the record and has gone on to become a bit of a mogul, but he, in those days he was a record producer. Jimmy was very often the person who heard the material first and commented on it. And there were always a few other kind of trusted critics of the material when it was in preparatory form. Gavin Friday particularly has always been kind of very close to the process. Mm-hmm. But I think the time I think it really sunk in how big it was going to be for me was in January of 87 when I gathered all the many licensees of Island Records from around the world in Cannes at the MIDEM convention, and they hadn't heard it till then. It was coming out a few weeks later, but those sort of records are kept very much under wraps. And I held a series of playbacks in the Carlton Hotel for those people. And, you know, they're kind of hard-nosed marketing and salespeople.
Yeah.
And I could just see the lights go on, and as they realized that they were about to put out, you know, a huge record. Mm-hmm. I think it always had that character. It was, you heard that record the first time, and you realized that it was going to be huge.
Let's move on, Paul, to Rattlin' Hum. If Joshua Tree was the band's love letter to America, then by the time it came to Rattlin' Hum, it was a full-blown affair. And you two decided to do this road movie, which then all of a sudden became this big Paramount Pictures production. The knives are out pretty heavily for Rattlin' Hum, the movie maybe more so the album. Why do you think that was?
Well, I think it had a lot to do with the way the movie was marketed, and I think it had a lot to do with me, actually. the way that records are marketed is traditionally through free media, through radio and television and editorial. There's very little actual advertising, paid media. Movies are different, and when a movie is being launched, you get it in the face if you're the public. It's on billboards, it's on TV, it's everywhere. It's paid advertising. We thought that by, you know, tying the record and the movie together in terms of the advertising look, the graphics, it would just be like having a bigger budget to advertise a record. And I think it didn't work out like that. I think the music buying audience aren't used to being marketed to like that. And I think a lot of the audience were kind of instinctively offended by the scale of the campaign, which was massive. It was a very wide release in America. I think 1,200 screens is what I seem to remember. And the plan to market the record basically was quite simple. It was to release to market the record and the movie. The plan was to release the record, get it to number one everywhere, and then release the movie a few weeks later. And that is more or less what we did. The record was a huge success, and then the movie came out. The movie, I think, suffered from too much control, probably. It was a documentary in part. It was also a performance film. But the documentary parts of it, and we shot, you know, millions of feet that never ended up in the film. The documentary part of it was, I think, a little too controlled, not that spontaneous. And the documentary maker, Phil Joano, never really got a chance to put his own point of view, to tell the story, if you like, in his own voice. And so in the end, the film was, to some extent, neither flesh nor fowl. The performance parts of it were fantastic, but the documentary parts were quite stilted, I think. And the success of the movie was very limited. It had a very short life. Mm. Basically, U2 fans went to see it, and that was it. Mm. So it was a disappointment for Paramount, who were the studio who had bought it. We paid for it ourselves. We made the film, and about halfway through making the film, we made a deal with Paramount that they would pick it up. Mm-hmm. It's a deal, a kind of a deal called a negative pickup, where a film in the course of production is picked up by a studio. And we had a lot of fun preparing the campaign, but I think in retrospect, we overdid it. If it had gone out in a more modest way, and if we'd allowed the audience to find it, it might have been better in the end. Mm-hmm. Certainly more dignified.
I remember when Octung Baby came out, Bono said, "This is the sound of four men chopping down the Joshua tree." Why do you think they were? Well, I don't know if keen is the word, but they were making a point of rejecting their most recent musical accomplishments. Do you think they became embarrassed by their love affair with America?
Well, I think one of the accusations at the time of Rattle and Hum was that this, you know, that U2 had not only gone to America, they were attempting to absorb and take credit for American music. In fact, it was much more. It was much more that they were fans of American music and were trying to incorporate the influences that that there were from American music in their own music and acknowledge it. But I think a lot of writers, and specifically John Perelis on the New York Times, he saw it as overblown and an attempt to claim American music, or claim ownership of it, which it wasn't really. But it was easy to see how somebody could get the wrong end of the stick. Rattle and Hum is a complex record. I like it a lot.
So do I.
It's half live and half studio, and that was actually the first time that Jimmy Iovine got into the studio with the band and produced them, produced new material. Mm. And the new material on Rattle and Hum that he produced in the studio is some of their finest work, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was also a great year. I think the time that the band spent in LA cutting the movie and making the studio parts of that record and mixing the live parts was extremely enjoyable. It was a great relief after all those years to sort of stop and draw breath. And we all enjoyed moving to LA for the best part of a year.
Mm. Let's talk about the deluxe edition, the reissued Joshua Tree for a minute, Paul. This is the first time that you two have brought out an anniversary edition. Is this because this is such a landmark album for the band?
Well, it's something that we've obviously been postponing. Part of that was for business reasons. I never really liked the way that record companies deal with catalogue. Normally, they just drop the price and pile it high. I don't think there's sufficient, respect shown by the industry for its treasures. And if we were going to remaster this record and put out the unreleased parts of it and the little nuggets of gold and unreleased content, we wanted it to be. We wanted a better deal than the one we had. Mm. And we got that agreement about a year ago. And we're now embarking on a process, which will go on for the next couple of years, of remastering all the albums.
Oh, excellent.
Pretty much like this.
Great stuff.
So that demos and extra material stuff that fans will enjoy will be made available. each time we do that, there'll be, if you like, a plain vanilla version of the record at normal price, remastered with the technology that's available now. But then there'll be a couple of options as well for at higher prices for, if you like, more serious fans who want to have everything. Mm. And so this time, I think the this sort of sets the stage for the future catalog releases, I'm looking forward to hearing them all. This coincided with the 20th anniversary of the Joshua Tree, so it's a bit of a landmark, and I can say we're all very proud of it. Looking at some of this material, the concert in Paris that's on the bonus DVD, an unreleased video directed by Neil Jordan, which we buried at the time. Then there's a documentary made during the early part of that tour by Barry Devlin, who was one of the band's great helpers in the early days. All these things are, you know, I think, great pieces of material. Nobody has to buy them, but U2 fans, I think, will be delighted.
Yeah. Is there any songs that are now on the bonus disc that at the time you would have loved to have seen on the album itself?
The one that at the time was the one that got away was Sweetest Thing. And we subsequently returned to that and got it right and had a hit with it.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, that song, I remember Louis Walsh calling me a few years ago and he said, "Have you got any old U2 tracks that'd be good for Boyzone?" And I said, "Well, actually, funny you should ask that, Louis. There's an old pop song that we never quite got right called Sweetest Thing might be good for Boyzone." And actually, Louis listened to it, and they didn't do it anyway. Yeah. But that explains why Boyzone appear in the video.
I thought it was because Ali is a fan.
There's that as well, and we got to know the guys over the years. But you know, if things had gone differently, that could have been a Boyzone hit, and we wouldn't have released it ourselves. This original version of it is pretty good.
Yeah.
Silver and Gold, which was a song Bono did with Keith Richard and Little Steven from the E Street Band. That was pretty remarkable at the time. And was sort of got forgotten. Song that we've had on the internet recently called Beautiful Ghost is a song I was really very sorry, not Beautiful Ghost, Wave of Sorrow. Wave of Sorrow is the song that's on the internet at the moment. Wasn't finished at the time, and Bono actually finished it a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
And we got it on the record. I'm really glad that finally saw the light of day. There's a number of things here that I really like.
I like Desert of Our Love.
Desert of Our Love, great track.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like the little sister to Stephen Found I'm Looking For, I think.
Yeah. I think they have the same chord pattern.
Oh, is that so? Well, the drums have sort of got me.
I think there's either a drum pattern or a chord pattern that's common to both. And that sometimes happens when you two are writing. They write in the studio, and bits of songs are kind of placed alongside other bits of songs and then rearranged. It's
Lady with the Spinning Head is like The Fly. Like, you can sort of see the genesis of all these songs and the B-sides.
Yeah, that's right. It's brave of them, I think, to open up their diaries.
Well, thanks a million, Paul. That's the guts of the interview, I suppose you can call it. Would you mind a couple of fan questions?
No, not at all.
We had people We mentioned on phantom.ie that people could text in questions and some of them will be asked to you. I'm going to read them verbatim. First one is from Tim Marsh. He says, just a question for the fifth member of the band. You two have always been a band that lives in the live domain, playing live is where the songs come alive, they get stepped inside of, figured out, and the tours always seem very different beasts at the end of them than at the start. Has there been any temptation to take the moment of a shorter tour and pour that into a record that is a quicker turnaround than the now standard four-year gap?
Yes, there's been much discussion exactly along those lines. You know, why not take the songs out on the road before recording them? And I'm sure those discussions will take place again.
Mm-hmm.
It never seems to happen. But your listener is absolutely correct. For instance, we always regard the pop album as unfinished and, you know, released in a hurry because there was a tour booked. If you listen to the music as it emerged from the end of that tour, which is the Popmart DVD, the music is much better, much more focused, in my view, than on the original album. And it's just something we've never been able to do, I suppose. The logistics are too hard to get on top of. We like to start each tour with new material, but it's new material that people are already, they already have in their hands, if you like. And you know, there is a complex interplay between the live versions and the studio versions, and the live versions do change over the years.
I thought it was interesting that they re-recorded Gone for the best of 1990-2000, and it is, it's, I mean, Gone is one of my favourite tracks from pop, but the new mix is an even better version.
Yeah, Gone is certainly a track that improved enormously when they had another go at it. I mean, from time to time, people talk about making that whole album again. I don't really agree with that because I think the records, they benefit from remastering. There's no doubt about that. But to go back over them completely, I think, is to disrespect the original. I think the original has an integrity that that has to be honoured.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks, Paul. Will you two? This is from Zulok, possibly not his real name. Will you two ever hold a concert in Serbia?
Serbia? Ooh, I don't see why not. We've played Sarajevo. The logistics of getting around that part of the world are rather difficult, but it's comparatively peaceful now, and I don't see any reason why not. Croatia, there have been shows in Zagreb recently, and Belgrade is a concert city nowadays. Yeah, maybe we will.
Good stuff. He also asks, will the band ever stop being unhappy with pop, which we've already talked about.
It is the one that comes up as... my own feeling about pop is that there were too many, too many cooks.
Mm.
There were just a lot of people involved in making that record, and it didn't have a kind of clear through line. And, you know, the idea of making it, you know, a modern record full of dance influences, which were very much in the air at the time, was never really delivered. You know, I think there were too many voices, too many opinions, and in the end, a confused through line.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Stephen Judge has asked us to ask you, is it true that the Joshua Tree was planned for a long time to be a double record? And that when many of the B-sides were recorded, it was always assumed they would be on the album. There are many rumours around. There was even a tentative track listing where songs like Luminous Times and Walk to the Water were a trilogy with the song With or Without You, and that some of the band felt that the record was incomplete without those songs together.
Those all sound like opinions that were expressed at the time, yeah. I mean, the debate is furious and intense when the record is being put together. And coming up to, you know, deadlines are you know, self-imposed, but, you know, sooner or later the record has to be finished. Mm. And there was talk of it being a double record, but I've often heard it said, and I agree with this, that there are very few double records that wouldn't be even better as single records.
Mm. Okay. Fearless Khatib has asked, will you two ever perform Exit live again? Thanks for everything. I can't wait to hear the next album.
Exit, God, that hasn't been in the set for a long, long time. I think it's slightly tainted by association with there was a stalker incident in Los Angeles where some guy who was harassing an actress said in court that he'd got the idea to go after her from that song. So I think maybe that's one of the reasons why it fell from favour.
Well, I don't know. If you two can steal back Helter Skelter from Charles Manson, they can certainly steal back Exit. That's more or less it, Paul. I'd be failing in my duty if I didn't ask you about how sessions are going for the new album.
Going very well. They've been working on the new album for some months with Eno and Lanois producing again. There's a shift of emphasis this time in that Eno and Lanois are also co-writing some of the material, as well as producing. So that will be, that leads to a different dynamic in the studio, and the sessions have been some in France. They went off to Morocco for a few weeks. It's going very well. I hear nothing but encouraging sounds from the participants. For me, though, it's, you know, recording is not the recording process is very difficult and very intense. And I'm not a musician and never was, and I'm not a great judge of material in its early stages. When it's close to completion, I can sort of start to focus on it. But the kind of concentration that it's necessary to have to make a great record and be a great band is not the kind of concentration I have. So I tend to visit for brief periods and then scarper.
Would it ever happen that Bono would ring you and say, enthusiastic, this is happening, then an hour later you get a phone call from Larry and it's the opposite?
No, I'm not really involved in the creative process to that extent at all. Yeah. Just as a commentator and as a critic when it's pretty well done.
Yeah. Great. Well, that's our lot, Paul. Thanks a million for talking to us.
Happy to be here.
Great stuff.
My favourite station.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Glad to hear. Thanks a million, Paul.
You've been listening to a Phantom 105.2 podcast. For more information, visit us at phantom.ie or email webmaster@phantom.ie.